Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present author David Daley, who examines the Trump GOP gerrymandering scheme that aims to rig the 2026 election, aided by the extremist U.S. Supreme Court majority that's methodically dismantling the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Candace Fortin of the global climate group 350.org, who assesses the consequences of the Trump EPA's repeal of its scientific finding that greenhouse gas emissions endanger human life, to dismantle all federal climate regulations. And the voices of U.S. Gulf South climate activists who recently protested banks and insurance companies in New York City for their role in financing fossil fuel projects that exacerbate the climate crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Trump regime has intensified its campaign to help Brazil's former right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, avoid accountability for his alleged role in masterminding a failed coup after his 2022 election defeat to his left-wing rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Since July, Trump has attempted to pressure Brazil to drop charges against Bolsonaro by imposing a 50% tariff on imports from the South American country and sanctioning Supreme Court Judge Alexandre de Moraes, who is overseeing Bolsonaro's trial. Moraes placed the former president under house arrest on August 4th in response to what the judge said was Bolsonaro's deliberate violation of a court order forbidding him from using social media or communicating with foreign diplomats. Federal police claim Bolsonaro's conspiracy included plans to assassinate Lula, his vice president, and Judge Moraes. The plot allegedly culminated on January 8, 2023, a week after Lula took power, when thousands of Bolsonaro's supporters stormed Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidential palace in what police claim was an unsuccessful attempt to launch a military coup with unmistakable similarities to Trump's own January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. In Florida's current home insurance crisis, much of the attention has been focused on huge premium increases for wealthy owners of pricey homes in coastal South Florida that are vulnerable to more frequent extreme weather events. But a recent investigation by Inside Climate News found that Florida's poor inland rural communities around Lake Okeechobee are an overlooked epicenter of the crisis, where data indicates a spike in non-renewals of home insurance policies. An increasing number of residents in this region fear these new insurance policies could drive them out of their homes. Over the last 6 years, insurance rates near Lake Okeechobee have surged 180%. A December 2024 report from the U.S. Senate Committee on the Budget drew a direct connection between spiking rates of home insurance policy non-renewals in 2022 and 2023 to climate change, noting that non-renewals were concentrated in the counties facing the highest risk of climate-related disasters. Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse said in a recent interview, "The stuff that scientists have predicted for decades about climate change are now starting to come true, and the leading indicator of that are the insurance industry premium hikes and cancellations." Right-wing pundit and social media influencer Laura Loomer has exercised real clout inside the White House owing to her friendship with President Donald Trump. Loomer, who has a blog and weekly video streaming show, has claimed credit for the firing of National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, Food and Drug Administration vaccine regulator Vinay Prasad, and canceled cybersecurity expert Gene Easterly's faculty appointment to West Point. Loomer was banned from social media for years for her Islamophobic views, but reinstated on X by billionaire Elon Musk. Since Trump was reelected in 2024, Loomer has increased her followers to 1.3 million. In 2017, she was banned from Uber and Lyft for viral rants against Islamic immigrant drivers. The self-proclaimed pro-white nationalist activist and proud Islamophobe is successful in raising money both from her followers and commercial sponsors. During one recent streaming tirade, Loomer took a brief pause from warning about how communists and jihadist Muslims were waging war to carry out the ultimate destruction of Western civilization to thank her sponsor, the Colorado-based gold merchant Kirk Elliott Precious Metals, and aired a commercial in which she contentedly ate popcorn as a violent mob raged outside her window. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Donald Trump and his Republican Party, fearful of being punished by voters in next year's midterm election for their wildly unpopular policies, such as major cuts to the nation's social safety net programs and inflationary tariffs, have taken the unprecedented step of pushing through mid-decade gerrymandering of congressional seats in Texas. The GOP hopes redrawing Texas maps will give them 5 additional seats, helping the party retain control of the House. But beyond Texas, Republicans are encouraging the gerrymandering of districts in other states, including Ohio, Florida, Indiana, Missouri, North Carolina, Kentucky, and New Hampshire. More than 50 Texas House Democrats recently left the state to deny Republicans the quorum needed to pass their gerrymandered maps. California Governor Gavin Newsom has threatened to ask voters to approve a referendum to bypass his state's nonpartisan Citizens Redistricting Commission to redraw the maps there, increasing the number of Democratic seats as a counter to the Trump GOP gerrymandering scheme. Your reporter spoke with David Daley, former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, who's the author of Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. Here, Daley discusses his recent Nation magazine article titled How the GOP Hopes to Gerrymander Its Way to a Midterms Victory and the U.S. Supreme Court's right-wing majority's role in methodically dismantling the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
We start with a House that is essentially 219 Republican, 216 Democratic. So 3 seats ought to be able to flip the House, and usually the party that's not in power in a midterm gains somewhere between 12 and 20. So Republicans are not satisfied with the 3-seat edge they have. They're looking to pick up about 5 in Texas. There will be 2 more coming from Ohio, 1 from Indiana and Missouri, most likely. Ron DeSantis is talking about 3 South Florida districts in addition to 1 in Orlando, 1 in Tampa. Don't know if he can get all 5, but he might be able to. And then there's a handful of other states that have been quieter but could also remap if they would like to and erase a Democratic seat off the board. Kansas has 1, Tennessee has 1, New Hampshire, Kentucky. So if you add all that up, you're looking at somewhere between 12 and 15 seats that Republicans could grab. And the thing about that, of course, is every time you grab additional seats, you're also shrinking the map, because there were only 37 districts in the country that were competitive back in 2024. And by competitive, I mean within 5%. So when you start knocking these competitive seats off the board, it means that Democrats have to really dominate the handful of seats that are left. It shrinks the eye of the needle that they have. An already difficult path becomes that much harder.
Thank you for that, David. Since 2013,
the Supreme Court, and this was the Shelby County versus Eric Holder case, since 2013, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court has been dismantling sections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the extreme right wing of the Supreme Court just accepted to hear a voting rights case from Louisiana about the legality of majority-minority congressional districts, setting the stage for a further erosion of protections from voter suppression targeting voters of color. You mentioned the Louisiana case in your article. I wonder if you'd expand a little bit on what we know about this case and how it could impact further elimination of protections under the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we're talking about this case. I'm glad we're talking about the court and its role here in really putting the Voting Rights Act through the shredder over the course of the last dozen years dating back to Shelby County. And the Voting Rights Act is the most consequential piece of American civil rights legislation in our history. This is what makes us a multiracial democracy. The right has been targeting it ever since it was passed. The very first challenge to the Voting Rights Act comes the month after it was passed, South Carolina in September of 1965, saying, we've fixed all of our problems here, everything's good. It took until 2013, it took until John Roberts and the Shelby County case ending preclearance for the arguments that South Carolina advanced in 1965 to become law. But that's really what happened. John Roberts in 2013 embraced the arguments that South Carolina advanced 60 years earlier in trying to duck out from under the Voting Rights Act. And Roberts and this court have, over the last 15 years, consistently on voting and election cases, pushed the country further to the right. You can start with Citizens United in 2010, unleashing unlimited dark money from billionaires into our politics. You can jump to 2013 and the Shelby County case. In 2019 is Common Cause versus Rucho, which has special relevance today because this is the gerrymandering case. This is the partisan gerrymandering case from North Carolina in which John Roberts and this court, at precisely the moment that federal judges around the country said, we have the tools to rein in the worst gerrymanders by Democrats in Maryland, by Republicans in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina. We can fix this. And also, if we don't fix it, nobody else will because the politicians can't and won't. And John Roberts looked at this and said, no. And he went a step further. He said, federal courts can't be in the business of policing partisan gerrymanders. He closes the federal courts to all of these claims in the future. John Roberts is the father of this moment we are in right now, this chaos that has been unleashed from coast to coast, this all-out mid-decade redistricting war was essentially created by the Chief Justice, who declined to embrace a federal national standard for a national problem, knowing, I imagine, that this chaos would reverberate to the advantage of the Republican Party and the people who put him on this court. Now, there is one more case coming up, the Calais case from Louisiana. This case has the ability to really end what's left of the Voting Rights Act. Roberts and the conservative supermajority have not left much. There is one remaining piece of Section 2 having to do with majority-minority districts across the South. They are going to rule on the constitutionality of those districts. If, as expected, they find a way to strike that down, to say, as they did in Shelby County, that things have changed, that these protections are not necessary anymore, it could wipe off the map black districts in Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, maybe Georgia. It would give them additional ability to go back into Texas and to eliminate some of these seats. You could see an additional half dozen seats erased in addition to the dozen that could come off the board right now. So this is really a five-alarm fire that people need to be paying attention to.
That was David Daley, former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, and author of Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. Find a link to his recent articles examining the Trump GOP scheme to gerrymander their way to midterm election victory in 2026 by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump campaigned for president in 2024, he talked about his plan to roll back most, if not all, environmental and climate regulations. On his first day back in the White House, he signed an executive order withdrawing the U.S. for a second time from the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, where nations around the world pledged to cut greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to the worsening climate crisis. In the recently passed federal budget bill, Republicans in the Trump regime cut every subsidy and tax rebate for clean energy passed under the Inflation Reduction Act, signed into law by President Biden. And in the administration's latest move to reverse progress made on climate change, Trump's Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin announced in late July that he's proposing to rescind the agency's 2009 declaration that determined carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. Revoking this finding will end federal regulation of emissions linked to climate change under the Clean Air Act for motor vehicles, power plants, and other sources of pollution. This reckless policy change, rejecting mainstream science, but applauded by the fossil fuel industry, is occurring as the world is experiencing the increasing severity and frequency of global extreme weather events, including floods, droughts, wildfires, and ever more deadly heat waves and hurricanes. Your reporter spoke with Candace Fortin, U.S. campaign manager with the global climate group 350.org. Here she assesses the consequences of Trump's dismantling of federal climate regulations and what, if anything, states can do to implement or strengthen their own local climate laws.
It's pretty much an earthquake. It's catastrophic because the EPA quite literally, and I know this sounds so reductive and, you know, I don't know what the EPA stands for anymore. It's supposed to be the Environmental Protection Agency. And what we're seeing is a complete erosion of that. If you entirely remove the EPA's ability to enact regulations around climate change or carbon pollution, then that affects so many industries. It affects the public health. It cannot come at a worse time when we're in our sixth year of record heat this summer, when we have so many catastrophic climate-related disasters, whether we're talking about the flooding in Texas, the LA fires, whether we're talking about Hurricane Helene, whether we're talking about Hurricane Milton. It's just really, really wild that at this time where we're at a really, really critical point where we need to address this crisis, that they choose to completely erode any sort of foundation of that lever at all. So it just really just brings to me a question around how is this still called the Environmental Protection Agency? If you take away any sort of regulations, anything that's going to actually serve the public health of the people and also to fight climate change, my personal opinion is that I don't understand the utility of the agency existing.
Candace, I know your organization has given some thought to how to counter the federal deregulation of greenhouse gas emissions in the courts, on the streets. And in addition to that, how about state capitals and state jurisdictions? What regulations are possible to strengthen at the local level here in states to counter what's going on under the Trump regime?
I'm based in New York. I live in Hudson Valley. I used to live in New York City for like 23 years. You've probably already heard about the New York's Climate Superfund bill, which is telling the energy sector, the fossil fuel sector, that they have to proactively commit to a $7 billion fund to make sure that there is renewable energy infrastructure as well as carbon reducing infrastructure to mitigate the harms that these companies put into place. This was a bill that was a landmark achievement, but it happened on the state level with a lot of advocates really pressuring and pushing Governor Hochul to sign this bill into law, and it worked. And I think a lot of that, those same sorts of bills can be achieved on the state level. I think that there's a lot that can happen there that can obviously impact the lives of millions of people. All is not lost. You have to just really focus on figuring out who your governors are, you know, reaching out to them, asking for them to take responsibility for their constituents, to prioritize climate whenever they are reaching their next legislative session. And I think there's a lot of levers that can happen there. I've also seen it on the city level as well. Mayor Brandon Johnson, who is the mayor of Chicago, mandated that every city-owned building is 100% renewable. That's a really big sweeping change that impacts the lives of millions of folks. So I do think that there's a lot that can be achieved. And, you know, I think if we decentralize that and we kind of build movements and we take notes from a state that was successful or a city that was successful and try to replicate it and like replicating that DNA, I think that we do have a really great opportunity to see what it looks like to kind of decentralize the movement versus relying on the federal government.
That was Candace Fortin, U.S. campaign manager with the global climate group 350.org. Learn more about the Trump regime's multi-pronged attack on environmental and climate regulations and the response of activist groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Anti-fossil fuel campaigners from the U.S. Gulf South joined other activists in New York City from July 28th to August 2nd for an action dubbed From the Gulf South to the Global South. Stop the Money Pipeline, a group that targets banks and insurance companies that enable the construction of methane pipelines and liquefied natural gas or LNG export terminals, co-organized the protest. The climate activists made connections between the U.S. petrochemical industry and its impact on countries around the world. The group also visited an immigration court in New York City to stand in solidarity with those facing Trump regime mass deportation. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us this report with the voices of some of the participants as they spoke outside the corporate headquarters of BlackRock, Citibank, the Chubb Insurance Company, and outside the homes of some of those corporate leaders.
Manny Robinson is from Freeport, Texas, and a member of the Gulf South Fossil Finance Hub. He was speaking outside the building where Chubb CEO Evan Greenberg lives.
All right, Mr. Evan, Manny Robinson, I am back. I promise you that we will come back. And we will always come back till you stop financing fossil fuels on the Gulf South. Yeah. You are killing our communities. Yeah. You are killing our children. Yeah. For what? A dollar. We are worth more. Our homes are worth more. The disasters are tearing up our communities. We just watched children in Texas drown. Why? Because of climate change. Yeah. What is a 100-year flood when we have them every year?
Tell them, man.
Evan, stop supporting financing that's a global climate changer that kills our community. Yeah. Yeah. It's just the 1% of this country has the American dream when the 99% is scraping for bread.
Tell them, man.
We pay taxes for everything that you are getting rich off of.
Yeah.
It comes off us and our community. And we say enough is enough.
Enough, yeah. Enough.
That was Manny Robinson from Freeport, Texas, with the Gulf South Fossil Finance Hub. Rochetta Ozan from Southwest Louisiana is founder and CEO of the nonprofit The Vessel Project of Louisiana. She has traveled the world building opposition, especially to LNG export facilities in her community and elsewhere. She was speaking outside the building where Chubb Board of Directors member Francis F. Townsend lives.
We have to show Francis and all of the other board members that we are real people.
That's right.
We are not just a location on a map.
Yes.
Because you know that's how they portray us.
Yes.
They go in the boardroom and they show a map full of land and they say, let's put this facility here. It doesn't show our homes. It doesn't show our small businesses. We have businesses in Lake Charles that just opened back up 5 years after a hurricane. 5 years they've been closed because they didn't have adequate insurance. We have homes that have not been rebuilt because they didn't have adequate insurance. Yet insurance companies like Chubb are financing and insuring the very facilities that make it hard for us to afford insurance. When I moved in my house, I wasn't paying as much insurance as I pay. My insurance has quadrupled. My insurance is now more than my mortgage. That is the reality for Louisiana. Some Louisianians are having to make a decision between paying their insurance and paying their mortgage because the state of Louisiana has made it illegal to have a mortgage without having homeowner insurance. So you have to make a decision which one you're going to pay. And while you're making that decision, your children are crying because they're hungry. People can't afford their medicine. And you know, yesterday I said I was sad, and I am. But at the end of the day, we're not fighting against anything. That is a narrative they need to change. We're not fighting against anything. We're fighting for something. We're fighting for our lives. We're fighting for our community, for our homes, for our children. We're fighting for our health. We're fighting for this world, for our neighbors, for clean air, for clean water. We are not against anything. We are for something. We are for what's right. We are for justice. We are for liberty. We are for the promises that were made in this country that are not being withheld. We are not the enemy. We are not the criminals. We are not the ones to be afraid of.
That was Raishetta Ozane, founder and CEO of the Vessel Project of Louisiana, part of a group of climate activists from the U.S. Gulf South protesting in New York City against the role of banks and insurance companies that finance fossil fuel projects that intensify the climate crisis. Learn more about the Gulf South climate groups and their allies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky, KMWV in Salem, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.